Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 103, where we will discuss the article by Stephen Barley and Gideon Kunda titled Bringing Work Back In, published in the journal Organization Science in 2001. This is part one of the episode where we discuss Barley and Kunda's commentary on how and why the study of work disappeared from organization studies beginning in the 1970s, and why it is important to prioritize work studies now. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Sam calling from Mexico City.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from rural Northamptonshire in England.
And this is Greta calling in from Windsor.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And welcome everyone to another episode where we're going to talk about the meaning and the study of work. So what we have is a fairly recent article, but a very important one nonetheless. And this is by Stephen Barley and Gideon Kunda. And it's titled Bringing Work Back In. No subtitle or anything like that. Very simple. This was published in Organization Science in 2001. And we had an episode with Kunda before, episode 49, I believe, on tech culture. A very important study he did. And we had Steve Barley with us for one of our recent professional development workshops we recorded at the Academy of Management annual meeting. So this is an opportunity to talk about the two of them together. Catherine, would you like to go ahead and introduce us to the paper?
I guess in the context of the podcast, 25 years isn't that long ago, but in a couple of years' time, it will have been 25 years since the paper was written. And the initial thinking behind it was to highlight the dearth of detailed studies of work and to review how this wasn't always the case and to look at how studies of work initially informed post-bureaucratic organizing. Some of which has been featured on some of our previous podcasts as well, and just thinking of Goldner and the Dalton one as well. And then in the paper, Kunda and Barley look at the methodological requirements for addressing this and what the payoffs of bringing the work back into the research might be. Without producing a bit of a spoiler, the payoffs would be breaking new conceptual ground, resolving theoretical puzzles, envisaging organization processes and revitalizing some old concepts. So quite exciting to get started on it.
Thanks, Catherine. And I found this a very striking article given our recent episodes where we had our 100th episode special where we talk about the future of organization studies and the subject of work came up with that. We had a recent episode with Shoshana Zuboff and her work in The Age of the Smart Machine, which covered the changing meaning of work. It's been a resonant topic for us for a bit of time, but this is an article that just seems to be one you have to have a conversation about. Their main argument begins with that early studies of organizations were concentrated on work in the workplace and was heavily focused on people directly observing work, interviewing workers, and getting really into the detail of work environments. And they're saying that that sort of disappeared towards the end of the 20th century in favor of perhaps more quantitative studies, different directions that they went, which just were focused on other things. Work itself and the practice of work just ceased to be interesting and rewarding. And they wanted to basically try to reverse that trend. This being 2001, my initial read, I'll only say and then turn it over, that it just seems like 2023 is very similar to what they commented on in 2001.
Yeah, I agree, Tom. I think I think this is a really nice paper because it talks a lot about these old, or not old, but classic studies of organizations and the main theories of organization theory. And I think we've covered most of these very classical texts. And it makes this nice argument that the reason why we were able to understand organizations and particularly linked to these ideas of bureaucratic organizations is because these studies used to be really close to the work, right? Like really grounded studies, inductive fields, close to the action. And I think it's a really nice paper for us in the podcast because it connects all these studies that we've done and also a lot of the questions that we usually bring into our episodes. So about the future of work and what is changing and is this still relevant and do we need new understandings, new concepts, new theories, etc. So I think, I don't know, I saw this paper as a very nice kind of connecting piece between our current interest and the work that we usually look back on and think about. So yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely reassuring, but also a little bit depressing because, as you say, you know, Steve Burley hasn't changed his tune since this paper came out in 2001 because maybe things haven't changed that much. You know, just listening to what he was saying on the Ethnography Atelier podcast as well, I was listening to that recently. He's still calling for work to be brought back in some way. Maybe we could look at why maybe that hasn't happened today. And I'm sure there's some opinions about maybe why that isn't the case.
Yeah, perhaps what we can do is start with their arguments back in 2001 as to why work left organization studies in the first place. This is a very short paper. It's only about 18 pages. And the front of it is, you know, after they give a very brief retelling of, you know, just basically how work was central, they then talk about what they refer to as interest or the growing interest in post-bureaucratic organizing. I think that was one of the things that they had said was one of the forces that sort of took us out of studying work was the notion that at the time, in the, say, the 25 years before the paper was written, other ideas about what organizing was about were starting to come in. And there was sort of the postmodern movements that we stopped thinking about hierarchy and started thinking about other constructs. And so they came up with in a section up front called Search for New Concepts. They talk, I'll just introduce one of them. The first one, which was conceptual inversion, when theorists formulate images of post-bureaucratic organizing by contrasting traditional models of organizing with their perceived opposites. So they talk about, for example, network organization. We've done some episodes on networks. The direction that scholarship seemed to go was to move away from the organization as a workplace and toward how do collectives of people behave as networks, and to explain everything through networks as opposed to the traditional language of organization. That by itself is not necessarily bad. You know, we have new theories precisely to try to explain things that are different from the mainstream interpretations. But they kind of said that this actually was somewhat tautological because all organizations were always networks. Well, what are we really adding? So that sort of is the way that they set the stage.
Yeah, those are very good points, Tom. And especially in more managerial writings, we saw this language of the networked organization becoming pretty dominant. Like, you know, journals like Harvard Business Review, California Management Review, MIT Sloan Management Review, more managerial articles in professional outlets. I think there are a few factors that led to, you know, losing the focus on work. Barley and Kuna referred to, in addition to the one of the networked organization. And one is this increasing focus on the environment to go towards more macro theorizing, to explain everything by just looking at environmental factors as the cause, and then making assumptions that, depending on the characteristics and more contingency approaches, organizations respond to these environmental changes in similar ways. Well, we've had a PDW about that as well, and why there was a demise in the contingency theories, and its continued relevance today. I think another important explanation that is given, and this is building on the work of John van Manen actually, is the rise of the computer. the rise of being able to better store and analyze quantitative data. So if you wanted to know something about work before, you just went to a factory and studied what people did, because this was like hardly documented, hardly archived, and hardly accessible to researchers. If you wanted to have access to that material, you had to get into the organization. And when you did so, you would also study how people did the work, not just study the archives. So that's another one where, with the rise of the computer, work became more quantified, especially the performance and the outcomes of work. And there was a shift in organizational research as it matured, and there was a more conceptual shift that people wanted to have more abstract theories. They started to change their vocabulary, drawing more upon systems theory, which, just like the contingency approach, also had its rise and demise over time. Something we haven't covered yet in the podcast, but I'm sure we will do in the next few seasons. So there were all trends that were discouraging organization theories to study work. And the fourth factor that is addressed in the paper is kind of how organization theory tried to distinguish itself from sociology, and industrial sociology in particular. And this is actually where I see, you know, especially in the past 10 years, I see better integration. So what happened was that the study of organizations became the responsibility of organizational theorists, which were in business schools. The study of work became the responsibility of sociologists, industrial sociologists studying professions. They had different academic communities, went to different academic conferences, and basically it led to a segregation of those two fields. But nowadays, if you go to the Academy of Management, a huge portion of the conference program is actually covered by a group of people that go through both conferences, published in both types of journals, see themselves embedded in both communities, and that is the people studying occupations and professions. And here we have a continuous and increasing focus on work. It has not at all gone. It is reviving. And another important community that is really focusing on work are the ones that are really trying to understand the impact of digital transformations and emerging technologies, how that is impacting work and organizations. And of course, I identify myself as one of those people. But definitely there we see already, like what Kunda and Barley wrote in this paper, the importance of developing new concepts, looking at older patterns of work. Like, we see a whole stream of scholars, young scholars emerging. I'm thinking, for instance, Hatim Rahman. I'm thinking about Jen Reimer's work on location-independent organizing. Like, there are numerous examples I can mention of young scholars that do really good work, really good research in studying work in different contexts, and really showing like what that can do in terms of, you know, coming up with new theories of organizing or better concepts to cover aspects of work.
No, that was excellent, and I greatly appreciate it, because I mean, when you mentioned the computers and the ability to do things quantitatively, it also reminds us of, at the time when you're talking about people going in to study organizations and doing so by being physically present or participant observation, all that sort of thing, you know, it was a little bit more intrusive. And in the earlier days of organization studies, it might have been easier to go ahead and get permission to do that sort of thing. The computer sort of, the appeal of it was that it allowed us to, you know, kind of be less intrusive. It allowed us to do things a little bit more from a distance, to collect survey data, to collect information in that way, which was convenient. And perhaps now we're recognizing, and we've talked about this before in other episodes, that it has its limitations. And we're now starting to see going back the other way.
Is cost at all a factor in this as well? If, you know, if a lot of researchers are based in business schools, and if you're applying to do research that is a longitudinal study, participant observation in the field, sometimes for years on end, you know, did that become more challenging? Was that a factor as well, why there was a move away from it? Is it a factor now?
That's interesting, actually, because one of the reasons I chose the program that I chose for the PhD it's because it wasn't a business school and the expectations was you will have more funding so that you can do these sorts of studies, as opposed to going to another school where funding might be more limited. And so it's harder to do like these, like I'm in a teaching at a policy school now. And, you know, I kind of feel guilty because I make my students fall in love with the idea of organizational ethnography. But then when you see that they only have very limited time and funding to actually do these studies, and, you know, it's not actually feasible. But yeah, I'm curious as to how much of a role that played. And also, like, something that Greta was mentioning about, I agree with you that I think in the last 10 years we're seeing more of a, like, these studies coming together. But I wonder to what extent it is a result of mentorship and, like, specific people that understand this as important, and so they try to have PhD students that pursue this kind of research, as opposed to whether we see it reflected on the program. And I think this also comes from a reflection of my own program, right? Where you don't really, just by looking at the program, you don't really see this emphasis on work and occupations and all of these for understanding organizations and for doing inductive, grounded work. But that was definitely my experience just because of the people that I was working with. So yeah, I wonder to what extent it's institutionalized or it's just about networks of people that see this as important. And yeah.
Yeah, I agree with your point, Samantha, these networks, embedding in networks of people that do similar work also inspires you to perhaps choose certain approaches in your study. And when you think about funding, one critical difference is that often US institutions, they work with five, six year PhD trajectories where students get 2 years of training in a variety of methods, in a variety of theories, after they select their PhD topic. Often they get a year to collect data and then have a couple of years remaining to do their analysis and write up their studies. And when you compare that to European trends, like there in our field, it is changing nowadays, but for instance, in the UK, it used to be that social science students, including the students at business schools, had 3 years for their PhD. That included like half year to a year of training. So how will you ever be able to produce the same quality of work in that reduced amount of time? And I think that did push students to do more qualitative work with existing data sets to just have more time for analysis and writing. And I do see the trend in Europe towards creating trajectories of equal length, like 5-6 year, as a context where you can expand like the types of questions that you ask, the type of methodologies you adopt to answer them, and having a greater variety of organizational research, just as it is reflected in US context. And I'm sorry, I cannot say anything about non-European and non-US context because I don't know much about it. But I do think that, you know, resource constraints leads to shorter PhD trajectories. And with deep ethnographic work often being based on ethnographies or research grants that allow for an extensive period of time where you don't have teaching obligations, this does lead to patterns where, you know, perhaps there is a demise in looking more up close at how work gets done.
Yeah, and I imagine that there's probably quite a bit of variance in trajectories within the United States in particular, because I was in a program where the trajectory was shorter. But part of it was because I was in a program where it was scholar practitioners. Most of the folks would choose their own organization. You know, they were a manager or a junior executive in their own organization, and that was going to be their location of study, which of course makes things a lot easier because there's all sorts of information that they're already privy to being on the inside. So there's a lot of ways you can shorten the time it takes to do research. And you also somewhat cut down on the amount of observation you might need just by being already immersed. But the problem then becomes, do you become vulnerable to some sort of organizational influence? Kind of also bringing some of Barley and Kunda's criticisms back in, some of the emerging ideas that crept in that then pushed work to the side, some of them just strike me as the product of fads, or there was like the hot topic at the time. If you wanted to do something on boundaryless organizations in the area of around 2000, it would have been easy to find a whole bunch of recent stuff that you could just riff off of, apply in your organization, poof, in about 18 to 24 months, you've got your research study done, and there you go.
Well, yeah, what you referred to were these fads and, you know, do you act upon fashions in recent trends versus really doing deep theoretical work based upon actual data. The whole idea that there are no boundaries, you know, my entire dissertation was about, you know, how in boundary-less settings people engage extensively in boundary work, because that's just a thing we do. It's not just a bad thing. Sometimes looking at distinctions between people can also support innovation and technology development. But even if you break down physical barriers, it doesn't mean there are no ways people distinguish themselves from others. I think that's quite a human tendency. Yeah.
Well, let me ask this question. You know, for things like networks, things like boundaryless organizations, with the emergence of those, do we think, and maybe based on what Barley and Kunder wrote, did those emerge because we felt like we had already saturated what was understood about organizations at the time, and we were just looking for something else to inject some new life or something?
Yeah, I think I find this idea of, they explain that what led us to maybe engage in work that is very detached from what actually work is like in organizations is because we wanted to have more abstract, generalizable concepts. But when you look at, I mean, we it doesn't matter what kind of work we do now, like we still build on and go back to the original classical theories that were based on studies of work. So maybe we have, you know, maybe we try to do that, but it wasn't very successful. And I think, yes, I think it's all part of this push or wanting to find the next big concept that will dethrone bureaucracy and show us that organizations now are fundamentally different than how they used to be before, right? What I really like about the criticism that Barley and Kunda do is that they're not necessarily saying that boundaries and environment and networks are not important, or they don't exist, or they're not there in organizations. It's the way we are studying them and the way we're using them to characterize organizations that is flawed, right? Like if we look at, for example, Greta's work, and we look at how in the work boundaries matter and how they engage in boundary work and all this stuff, then it's much more powerful than saying that organizations are boundaryless, period, right? So yeah, I think maybe this effort to find the next big thing, I mean, post-bureaucratic organizations, which is what the umbrella term that they use to refer to all these movement away from work, right? Like trying to make sense of what this new organizational forum is going to be like.
I like your use of the word dethrone there. That's that kind of speaks to a sort of an attitude towards.
Agreed. And, towards, you know, I think instead of focusing on the one grand theory that will describe post-bureaucratic organizations, I think what we've also seen in recent years is going more meso level. I do think that is informed by people that do study work and try to connect more macro theories of organizational change or change in organizational forms to more micro observations of how work gets done, how people identify the behaviors of people or specific leadership challenges, to find that meso level, that in-betweenness. I think it's very easy to do like a thought play about, you know, when you don't study the work, if you want to know something about post-bureaucratic, well, it is not bureaucratic, it's post. So everything that's, all the concepts are there, can we find the alternative? You know, if it's not power and control, perhaps it's network. If it's not clear structures, roles, and departments, perhaps then it's boundaryless. This is very simplistic thinking. It's, you know, easy hits. It's a nice way to get popular in the managerial literature. But if you look, like, boundaries, networks, power and control have always been there. They may just manifest differently. I would say there are two ways Barley and Kunda makes us think differently about how work is structured in organizations. And one is focusing on the team level and really seeing organizations as contexts in which teams operate, because they say, you know, that is kind of a distinguishing feature of post-bureaucratic organizing, is that more and more work is organized in teams. Doing work requires more skills in collaborating. It's not only the responsibility of the manager, but also the team members themselves. And I think that is a trend we have seen clearly also during the pandemic, that everybody needs to have, you know, learn new ways of doing that to get work done. So seeing organizations as context in which teams operate is a different level of analysis. It's a meta level of analysis to look at, okay, what structures do teams set up and how can they vary in the same context? How do they vary across contexts? And this also refers to the comparative approaches that they sketch out later in the paper, where they have like three different approaches. The second approach that they make us think about work is thinking about professions as communities, where we don't necessarily make a career in an organization anymore, but often we see us making a career in communities where we might do the same job across organizations. We might liaise with colleagues doing similar work to update our skill sets. That organizations are just part of, you know, the networks or the fields or the environments in which we do work. And I found that an interesting approach as well, especially when you think about more and more work becoming contingent, people having blended careers where sometimes they work as a freelancer, sometimes they're employed for a period of time, but really understanding like, okay, what are the new contexts in which people make their careers? I thought that was also a very fruitful way to think about work in a post-bureaucratic context.
And also they emphasize as well how the importance of project-based work, how work is a center for projects and how that can be used as focus for theorizing as well. Just anecdotally, you know, I've always, my work is very much project-based and I absolutely feel like I work within a community of practice rather than a traditional firm in a consultancy. But generationally, it's interesting when you speak, well, I find when I speak to people maybe 20, 30 years older than me, the concept of work being project-based and not your job, not being the role or the job title that you have for what you do, really confusing. It's still not understood really, or perhaps even valued. And, you know, maybe underneath all of this is a bias against project-based work. You know, is it seen as real work? Is it valued? Is it seen as worth theorizing about? You know, is it worthy of research?
I think one of the things you're bringing up is one of the critiques that Barley and Kunda have about the what they call the petrified images of work and the difficulty that we generally have, not just in academia, but also in practice, of explaining new ways of organizing, new ways of doing things, new ways of tasks, new ways of doing communities, you know, which are vastly different from sort of the mainstream thought of what organizing is about. And this was one of the sections I really enjoyed reading because it's one that bothers me a lot, that we use a lot of old metaphors to describe what are supposed to be new things. So, for example, one of the things that they mention is the language of work, the problematics of distinguishing what is quote unquote blue collar versus what is quote unquote white collar, which isn't, you know, it was a definite thing during the early days of organization where you had a stratification of roles and responsibilities that was very cleanly divided between education levels and all that sort of thing. But as they said, the utility of distinguishing them fades with each passing year as factory and other traditional blue-collar jobs disappear. And the blending of what is blue-collar with a lot more education and skill development associated with a lot of blue-collar work nowadays, you know, the reduction of white-collar, traditional white-collar work, low-level management, you know, it's a whole changing landscape, but we still tend to use those terms, or we tend to hear a lot of those terms still being used. And the other one I'll point out is the section they put on ideal typical occupations. And one of them is the worker on the assembly line as an ideal type, as a way of painting, you know, who's the worker? What does the worker do? The whole ecosystem around the worker. And that is also tends to be outdated, but it's one that we can't quite extract ourselves from. And we still hear some of that same language trying to be affixed to discussions about the gig economy. The challenge is trying to come up with new terms that can communicate this to people who, you know, to practitioners or whatever, that makes sense to them. And it's just a challenge. And I applaud them for bringing that out.
Yeah, I really love this idea of, you know, this criticism that they do on these petrified images of work. And it's for a reason slightly different from what they develop in the paper. But for me as a organizational scholar interested in studying organizations and work in Mexico and in Latin America, just these really, you know, spoke to my frustration of, if we focus on the work, we can eventually develop theories that speak to our realities as opposed to always trying to compare what we observe in this context against these classical, you know, theories and concepts that were developed primarily by studying organizations in the US and some in Europe. And so, yeah, I really love this. For me, that's the true value of this paper. And I actually teach it a lot in my organization theory class to my Mexican students, also because of this reason, right? Like, we need to begin by studying work, and then that way we don't get caught up in, you know, if we try to speak to theories of bureaucracy, we would get told that the organizations we're studying are not actually bureaucracies because they don't look like the ideal type and this sort of thinking, right? So yeah, for me, this criticism and these points that they make is just probably the most valuable thing in the paper.
And relatedly to that, you know, when you look at work taking place in other labor markets, like often we refer to the gig economy, but, you know, the online labor market spans countries, it spans continents, it's very much a global phenomenon. Often the work that is increasing in volume in these labor markets are often jobs and skills and roles that didn't exist before, that haven't been taken up in taxonomies, existing taxonomies. So this is also a big challenge for the people that try to govern these labor markets and the market interactions. Like, how do you best match people with jobs when there is no language to capture what skills they have? Like, how do they build, what taxonomies do they use to build their algorithmic matching? And how do you match people when the clients and the freelancer use totally different languages and vocabularies to describe what they do or what they need? You can find similar issues in other marketplaces, like, for instance, Etsy. Like, customers on Etsy often just use generic keywords to search what they want as a present for Christmas. But the people that run their Etsy shops think they have to really distinguish themselves from the competition to be very unique. And yeah, so you see like really big issues emerging because we don't have good taxonomies capturing what people do. And especially when you let go of the idea that you hire for a role or you hire for a cultural fit, but you hire for skills and capabilities to get work done. Or when you think like it might not be an HR manager, but a local line manager posts a job and it doesn't have any expertise in hiring. Like, you know, how then does that influence the labor market dynamics? Like, who does get the opportunity there and who doesn't?
Is that a factor then in why a lot of this work is so short term? It's because so much is still unknown about it.
Well, I think as academics, we have captured the work that is more short term because those were the people that we were able to interview because they were looking for jobs. So clearly there is also a need for them to accept, like, you know, a research interview. I think a lot of the freelancers that kind of derive a stable income from freelance work, they're not interested in participating in research because, you know, their hourly rates might be $200 an hour. And if they accept a $5 interview, that actually reduces their, influences the algorithm so much that they say, no, we don't take that risk. So definitely, you know, we have studied the short-termist work And definitely, I think that's a big part of the gig economy also, because a lot of these firms have other intermediaries to do more longer term work. Where's the gap? Like, where does this fit in? Okay, let's start with minimum risk, doing really short term things. But the firms that are pretty advanced, they sometimes work for years with the same freelancer, and it's just remote, and they have W-2 employment. Like, that's the description for long term employment in the US. Just the difference is it's remote and this person doesn't live in your country or in your city, but they might be on the other side of the world. And what I find interesting is, you know, the line of research that is emerging here that does lead to new vocabularies, new concepts. Like, one of the studies I would like to highlight, which I really enjoyed reading, is the study of Hatim Rahman and Melissa Valentine. It's on how in freelancer work engagements, when there is a conflict, how some managers are unable to repair the conflict, and then it really gets into a dispute or the work just ending. But there is also like unique practices that some hiring managers on these platforms develop, which they call collaborative repair, where when you get a conflict with a freelancer, rather than, you know, ending up in a fight or in a dispute, you find ways to repair the relationship, to complete the work. And they say that's like a unique skill that managers need in this new economy of work online, is to be able to repair relationships. If you're not, like, you won't be able to get the work done. It just ends into bad outcomes for everybody. So here you see like detailed studies of work engagements and the conversations between hiring managers and freelancers, and really leading to new concepts that we can also extend to other contexts. Like, in no way this is unique to digital labor markets, I think. When you think about like other contexts where work is being mediated, or even when you think about normal work, like if you have an issue with your employee and your employee is high skilled, they can quickly find like a new job and move on. So if you want to keep them, you have to think more about, okay, how can I repair this relationship? And do I always have to use the formal channels that are set up for that? Or is there a way to do that collaboratively? Like, I have another example that I can bring in, but go ahead, Sam.
Please. No, I was going to like comment on what you said. Maybe I can do that and then you can bring in the other example. But no, I really like, you know, the discussion and the points that you're making, because I think it shows exactly what the authors are arguing and suggesting, right? Like, there's a big difference between doing very grounded work that you're able to understand the dynamics and the mechanisms and what workers are actually doing. And then after you understand that so well, you're able to see it in many other contexts. So there is potential for it, you know, being generalizable. But, and that's very different from what I think they're criticizing, which is, you know, you've come up with this very abstract, general, broad concept that more or less applies to everything. So therefore, it's not really explaining anything. And it's not explaining how the organizations work, what the interaction is between work and organization, like all these other issues that are supposed to be the core of our field. So yeah, I think it's a really great example.
Well, it also speaks to me to just, in general, some of the challenges that are now faced in trying to pursue these theories. So if you have, you know, populations that you just simply can't access because the risks are too great to them, or your presence would be intrusive if they're on such a tight hourly rate and the controls over their behavior, what they do at any given time, are so unpredictable that it's difficult for them to engage with you. And they're remote, which adds a whole different dimension to the quality of the interactions you might have with them. You know, I mean, obviously it can be done, but it's different from a traditional observation. You're limited in what you can do, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. You know, how strong is the theory going to be? I guess generalization becomes a way of trying to bridge a gap that, you know, and try to encourage further research in something. Like, say, here is a big, broad theoretical concept based on what I've studied here, and let's put it out there in hopes that others can perhaps pursue or correct the limitations of what I just studied. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely. And if you think at the gig economy as a context where only a part of the global online labor market is accessible, by, you know, posting the invitation to interview them, you might have to think about other ways of accessing that community. Them is, you know, becoming a freelancer yourself and really getting embedded in these local online communities, like going to their meetings, being part of their other platforms like GitHub or whatever, really getting embedded and find the people that do similar work online, as so you can say something about that occupation that decides to do work online. For instance, you know, a huge portion of software engineers in Russia, in Ukraine, in Eastern Europe, in India, they all start to do freelancing work. And you know, I've spoken with a lot of them, and they say, you know, this pays better than the jobs that are available in where I live. And it allows me to live closer to my family. It allows me to have a better work-life balance. You know, because I worked with the platform, I did my ethnography inside the platform, I was able to find those people and speak with them. But of course, also that is only a subset of the global labor market. So we need to think about, like, what are the boundary conditions of the theories that are in the concepts that we generate? Like, who do we actually, can we actually say something about? If I reflect upon it, that's a question that, you know, the early organizational theorists that were studying, doing observations of work, they were also struggling with that. Like, the whole notion of having, like, universal concepts that can explain, like, so many different phenomena in so many different contexts, it was in sync, in alignment with the move away from studying work. And perhaps by studying work again, we can put things better in context. Like, okay, like you said, Samantha, like, you shouldn't have to justify that you study work in a Latin American context. Like, you know, why do we have to justify studying non-US context? Like, to me, that is just a crazy thing.
It is.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.